Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Leadoff double, no out. First and third, one out. Eric Thames
no
strikes
runs.
Out. Victor Robles strikes out. I can't do it.
Victor
Tony.
Robles strikes out looking all the time. He's got more than one strikeout a game.
FP said he's a lot more disciplined than the strike zone this year.
Yeah, he's not swinging. He's very disciplined. He's not
just
swinging.
Just working on his two-strike approach.
I just can't
do it. Get out of here.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
All right, so when you do a podcast, you plan for it. The plan originally was not to do one today. The plan was that I would not be in Washington, that I would be in Delaware, and we weren't even going to have it. But those plans changed, and I decided to do a podcast. And one of the reasons I did is because this is inside baseball for people. This is actually the last day of my contract year. In other words, I start September 1st and I end August 31st for purposes of how many shows you do in a year and stuff like that. Because of the pandemic, we haven't been able to do the type of show or the amount of show that I've wanted to do. But this gets us to a very, very nice round number, 170. So I was very pleased to be able to do this show. I had a lot of things to talk about, including a disastrous barbecue thing with chicken over the weekend that I wanted to talk about. And I certainly wanted to talk about, having watched both putts live yesterday, and we will get to this with Steve Sands, both putts live yesterday, Dustin Johnson on what was the last stroke of the tournament, either way, make or miss, hits a 43-foot putt to force a playoff, and then John Rahm, from essentially the same place, except maybe 15 to 20 feet further back. 20 feet further back.
Feet.
Hits the same putt.
DFC.
And wins right in the middle, right in the heart. And I wanted to talk about all that. And I'd planned to talk about all that. And then, Nigel, about 10 minutes ago, you texted me what?
Some very sad news that's being reported that former Georgetown head coach John Thompson has passed away at the age of 78.
Now, this is being reported by 980 Sports Radio, and it's being reported by WJLA, which is Channel 7 in Washington, D.C., and you don't ever get this wrong, right? If you get this wrong, you're out of a job. So I'm going to assume, even though I don't have anything else to go on, I'm going to assume this is true, and I'm going to change the beginning of this show, and I'm going to talk a little bit about John Thompson, who I admired greatly. And I liked an awful lot, and always, in tribute to John Thompson, I called him a worthy adversary. He was very difficult to cover, very difficult. He was an extraordinarily private man, extraordinarily large man, and could use his size to be extraordinarily intimidating. He's very, very smart. So covering Georgetown with John around, with the notion of Hoya paranoia in the late 70s and early 80s, stretching through the 90s, made it very difficult for a lot of people to get to the truth. You couldn't really talk to anybody on the team unless John gave you permission. You could talk to John, and to talk to John at Georgetown, you had to go upstairs, three or four flights of stairs, and go through four or five locked doors. It was honestly like the beginning of Get Smart. I mean, you made an appointment with John, and John did everything he could to intimidate you physically and intellectually. And John and I got along. John was not able to sleep. I'm not saying he was an insomniac, but he did not sleep much. So the best interviews, and Wilbon will be on later in the show, and he'll tell you this. So John would call you at 2 or 3 in the morning, return your calls at 2 or 3 in the morning. And I made it very clear after the first time he did that I wasn't going to do that anymore. I wasn't going to get up at 2 and 3 in the morning to take these calls. Others did. Junior did. Wilbon did. You pretty much had to if you covered the team. You had to do that. And John was always engaging. Look, I wrote a big piece about 20 years ago for an ESPN book on the greatest athletes of the 20th century. One of them, and deservedly so, was Bill Russell, the greatest winner ever in the NBA, Bill Russell. And the entire story that I wrote about Bill Russell, because I didn't talk to Bill Russell, because Bill Russell didn't talk to anybody. He didn't talk. So there was no point in me even talking to Bill Russell. I later heard from a family member that Bill Russell said, well, why didn't he ask to talk to me? And I started to laugh because Bill Russell never talked to anybody. I went to John Thompson. You'd say, well, why would you go to John Thompson? Well, John Thompson was Bill Russell's teammate and backup center for the Boston Celtics for a few years in the 60s. John Thompson was himself a great basketball player at Providence College and was in the pros backing up Bill Russell. And John Thompson was so smart and could tell me all about Bill Russell, tell me everything that I didn't know. And the quotes in that piece are all John. I could never thank John enough. I had, as I said, an odd relationship with John, but it was filled with admiration and respect and even some good humor. When John, after John retired, and I was at John's retirement, when he left Georgetown, he just left one day and called a bunch of people up and had a press conference. And we laughed about the fact that the bird of prey was sitting in the stands when John talked. And at some point in our lives, John and I think it was when Princeton played Duke and may have even beaten Duke at the Downtown Arena in Washington, whatever it was called at that point. They may have even beaten Duke. And John was there to watch his son, John III, JT3. And John knew that my son at that time was playing golf at Penn. And so they had the Princeton and Penn connection. And John and I just talked about taking enormous pride in our children and their accomplishments, athletic and academic and social. And we had, you know, about a 10 or 15 minute chat about that. John was very, very kind to Mark Asher. Mark Asher had, for the Washington Post, Mark Asher had all sorts of physical troubles. And John, in that big, booming voice, which, by the way, when there was nobody in the arena, you know, like 3,000 people, and John wanted to scream, everybody in the arena could hear him. And John used to take Mark Asher into the locker room. Nobody went in the locker room. John didn't let people in the locker room. He took Mark Asher into the locker room, put his arm around Mark Asher, and John's 6'10", 6'11", Mark's about 5'8", puts his arm around him and goes, I'm taking in my buddy Mark because we're a couple of misfits. John liked to say that about himself. We're a couple of misfits. John felt alienated. There are a variety of reasons why John Thompson would feel alienated. He's 6'10 or 6'11, weighs over 300 pounds. He's a black man in a white world, the world of Georgetown. There's no question about that. He had a tremendous chip on his shoulder. And he was really, really smart. So he felt every slight against him more deeply than others would because he understood the motivation. He understood the cunning with which these things are said and the cruelty with which these things are said. And I'm not going to paint John as the world's most lovely, friendly guy because he wasn't that. He was, as I said, intimidating almost to a fault. You know, you had to be really in the inner circle for John to put his arm around you and smile, which he did with me once or twice. He did with Wilbon many more times than that, I'm sure. But he was really, really smart. And the troubles that we see now, the racial troubles that we see now, John was on this 40, 50 years ago. It sort of defined John's life and his political outlook. And it's, which is not to say that he lived in an exclusively black world, because of course he did not. You couldn't do that at Georgetown. And his attorneys and his agents and his accountants, you know, he had multiracial people in his life. But John saw the world in a rather myopic way, and he saw it as being intellectually and physically violent from one group of people to another. And he was a hard guy. Like, you just couldn't drop in on John Thompson. You really couldn't. It didn't work that way. You had to make an appointment. He's a Hall of Fame coach. He won the national championship. He became the United States Olympic coach. And of course, because of everything that ever went on around John, because he was an enormously large black man, everybody looked at it, well, is he going to let white people play? The narrative of his coaching life was so unfair and so ridiculous. Will he have Danny Ferry on the Olympic team, or will he not because he's a white player and John doesn't want white players? None of that was true. None of that was true, but it became the sort of spoken word about John, and it was always unfair. And Wilbon, I'm sure, will talk at great length about this, because it was always unfair. John was a great basketball coach and a great leader of men, and a very, by the way, conservative fellow, socially, very conservative. He didn't like, if you, in the style of the 90s, if you cut messages into your hair with your haircut, John say, get out of here. We're not having any of this. Go see your barber. We're not having any of this. And John, I don't know if John ever felt he fit into Georgetown well, but boy, oh boy, Georgetown should have been, and I believe was, very, very proud of John. Opened up that institution. I mean, he couldn't do it in the chemistry department or the English department, but he could do it in the basketball department. Brought Georgetown enormous credit and made Georgetown, because of him, made them a lightning rod. Again, it was never easy. It's why I always said he was a worthy adversary. I mean, did I think I was as smart as John? No, I thought I was close, though. You know, I thought I was close. I thought I could go back and forth with John a little bit. And we often did that. I just used to burn me that he wouldn't make his players accessible because I was a sports writer. You know, and if Patrick Ewing had to be accessible at the Big East tournament, Patrick Ewing, you would ask him a question. He would say, would you please repeat the question? You would repeat the question. He would say, I have no comment about that. This came from John. I mean, everybody understood this, you know, and yet he would also make Patrick available to certain people who he trusted, who he thought were not out to hurt Patrick Ewing. And that's he was, and I don't know if he wanted to be this, but he accepted that he was this. He was a great father figure to his players. A great father figure to his players. He took them away from their homes in disparate places like Boston and New Orleans. And he told that family, I got your kid. Everything is going to be okay. And it was. He took people difficult people. Allen Iverson, difficult circumstance. Allen Iverson was a great player for Georgetown. And that was a difficult circumstance. Allen Iverson had been to jail already. A lot of people at Georgetown said, we don't want him. And then they ended up loving him, you know, as everyone did who ever watched him play. John had tough guys. Victor Page was a tough guy. Michael Graham was a tough guy. Yeah. Michael Graham lived on the edge in all ways, and helped John win a championship. And John was a father figure to them. Then John went into the media, and he was terrific. He was terrific. Nigel, you worked with him, did you not?
I did. Yeah, everything you said, I mean, it's so dead on.
He was terrific, and he suffered no fools. John Thompson did not suffer fools. He did not.
And I will say this. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that one probably didn't get to see on the sidelines, but if you listen to his show, if you got to see him off the air, when he would laugh, I mean, he took such mirth in things.
Great laugh.
And for some reason had great affection towards me. And when you're talking about, you know, his arm around a 5'8" guy, he would do that to me occasionally. And you just felt like you're on top of the world. I mean, you just revered this guy. And he just, larger than life. And it was.
I really mean that. I don't say this about a lot of people. In all ways, John Thompson seemed to me larger than life.
Yeah.
And every encounter I had with him. Well, not everyone was great. Believe me, they were not great. He could yell and be dismissive. Yes. He could do that. And he did it to me. And I think he did that to test your resolve, to see if you would come back at him. I think he respected that. I always thought he respected that. If he laughed so heartily when I made fun of David Falk. He just was thrilled that I called Falk the bird of prey. He would talk to me and he would say things like, well, maybe we would have the bird come into this discussion. And I go, no, he can't have that. You know, so he had a great sense of humor. He had a great intellect. I'm using the word past tense, you know, had, and that's difficult for me, because I think of him as very present in my life and very present in the life of Washington, D.C. Grew up here, went to Carroll, I believe. Did he go to Carroll? Wasn't he on some great team with Monk Malloy and Tom Hoover and people like that, one of the greatest high school basketball teams of all time? Or did he coach at Carroll? One of those things is true, but he was on a great basketball team.
Oh, yeah, Archbishop Carroll. Yeah, no, he was there and then went to Providence after that. Yeah, so.
Yeah, and he was a great player. I mean, you know, people, because of John's girth, people probably don't have any sense of what a terrific basketball player he was. But he, again, he backed up Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics. He loved Red Auerbach. He idolized Red Auerbach. Much of the piece that I wrote, and I wrote it through John's words, were about the relationship of Red Auerbach and Bill Russell, who were both in the city of Boston for different reasons, Red Auerbach being Jewish and Bill Russell being black, who both felt a certain alienation and both created something triumphant in Boston, the likes of which the NBA had never seen before and never seen since. And John was intimately aware of all of that. I will miss him tremendously personally. We will take a break. Michael Wilbon will join us. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
All right, let's do an ad. Let's do Box of Awesome, something I like. As we settle into the new normal version of summer, Bespoke Post is here with customized Box of Awesome collection for guys, guaranteed to upgrade your life. Michael, Nigel has the scrimshaw knife. What do we have? You've got bar glasses or something, right?
I do, and I also have the Dutch oven and the cold brew coffee craft, but I'm on the website to see if there's any. Oh, they have a hatchet.
A hatchet?
All in. I want to throw this hatchet.
All right, let's throw it against the wall. Bespoke Post only sends guys the best stuff every month. No matter what you're into, Box of Awesome has you covered, from style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear. That's what a hatchet would be, an outdoor gear. Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. To get started, take the quick quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right Box of Awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel anytime.
They have a Forge category, okay. All in.
All right, that's great. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. You can get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com, and you enter the code Tony at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code Tony, for 20% off your first box. And please, people, use the code.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Socially distanced from Uncle Ben's table.
This is Pat Finnerty, who writes, I came up with this tune and think you guys might dig it. My cousin surprised me on my birthday by submitting my music to you, but in hindsight, those recordings stink. I'm hoping to make up for it here, and I love the show. This is called Uncle Benny's Table, where Michael sits 6 feet away from me, correctly socially distanced. Michael Wilbon joins us now. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I was prepared to talk about a whole lot of things and not John Thompson, but when I found out about John, I opened the show. And Mike, what I talked about was his intellect, his size, his difficulty when he called you at 2 and 3 in the morning, where I said pretty early on, we're not going to play this game anymore. Play it with Wilbon and Junior. You're not playing it with me. And the fierceness with which he coached and was indeed a father figure to his children, and the sort of inevitability that a man of that size would and that color would see the world in very stark racial terms. You knew him better than I, and spent much more time around him. It is so hard to believe he's gone, but he was indeed larger than life, yes?
Yeah, Tony, I found out late last night, and, you know, as if you can have any, you know, as if anything good can happen in 2020. You know, just this is just another thing. But John Thompson is the most complex, fascinating person I ever covered and maybe have ever known. And, you know, it's interesting because it started out, I was 21 years old, and George Solomon, our boss for so many years, person who hired both of us, person who started my career at the Washington Post, assigned me to Georgetown basketball when I was very young. And Big John in his way, he wouldn't even talk to me. He wouldn't speak to me. I was covering the team. He wouldn't talk to me. And it's just funny that at the beginning, that's how it starts off, because John is so distrustful of anyone at the beginning.
Oh, you have to, people don't understand this. You have to go through a series of locked doors to see him.
That's right.
You have to do.
And I smile about it now, and you smile about it now, too. At the time, it was daunting.
Oh.
But then, you know, I don't know that any man other than my father had the impact on my life that John did. And I mean that, literally. I got to know him, I got to know him more than reasonably well. And I started thinking last night, you start thinking about these stories and what are you going to talk about when you talk about Big John in my case. And, there's dozens of, if not scores of stories. And one of them that comes to mind is when John had to deal with Washington, D.C., his hometown, and the threat that it became. Every major city became just a threat to young people with drugs. And, of course, you know the entire, Rafael Edmonds story.
Rafael Edmonds story, yeah.
Basically John, summoned a guy and said, people are like, what do you mean you summoned a drug kingpin? It's like John summoned him.
Yeah.
But before he summoned him, John wanted to go and look for him in the streets of Washington. Look for him physically. Find him. Talk to him. And in the process of one of those desires he had, he called me early in the morning, and he said, this was not at 2 o'clock in the morning. This was early in the morning. This was 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I don't know. I'm going to work. He said, no, you're going to come meet me at the office. And I meet him at the office. He didn't tell me what was going on. He said, get in the car. We're going to go find Rafael Edmonds.
This is a guy who spent a lot of years in jail, Rafael Edmonds.
We're going to go. We got in the car. We got in Big John's car. Big John is driving. I am in the passenger seat. And we drove through Washington looking for him. Stopping at restaurants, neighborhood stores, gas stations, anywhere that John thought he might be. Thank God we didn't find him that day. But he was completely, he was John Thompson.
He's a confident man. It is extremely possible.
It is extremely possible.
In Washington, D.C., in the environs of Washington, D.C., that he was the best known person, including the President of the United States.
Yeah.
It's possible.
This was in the early 90s, probably, if not. Maybe it was late 80s. I can't remember anymore. No, because Alonzo Mourning was in school. So Alonzo was like, 92? So, it was 1990, 89, 90, 91, somewhere in there. And there's just so many stories. There's just so many of them. I just said that John didn't even speak to me when I first covered the team. It so helped me learn how to be a reporter. John Thompson affected my ability to do my job because he didn't give the easy way out and just answer the phone and talk to me. I had to get to know Louis Carnesecca and Raleigh Massimino and Rick Pitino. I had to get to know all of the Jim Boeheim, all the Big East coaches, all of them. And I got to know them. I was so much better at my job because John didn't make it easy. And, like a year into this, John says, you still hate me, son? I said, I never hated you. He said, good, because you got to know all these coaches. He goes, I read all the stuff you write. You got to know all of these guys because I allegedly hated you. And it's so funny. And while he allegedly hated people in the media, the biggest wreath of flowers at my father's funeral in 1987, the biggest wreath of flowers in the funeral home said from John Thompson. The next largest wreath said from Georgetown basketball, as if they weren't one and the same. I walked into my house after my dad had died it was in March 11th. So he's getting ready for March Madness. I didn't even call John to tell him. I was covering the team. I didn't call him. I just went home, flew home to Chicago. I got there. My mother is on the phone for like an hour. And I was like, get off the phone. What are you doing? We got stuff to do. And she finally got off the phone. I was at home. I'm making my own calls. And I said, who was that? She said, that was Coach Thompson. He just called. We just had a chat. And she would never tell me what they talked about, and he would never tell me either. And you know that John could infuriate you, but by that point, that was over with me. I got over that stuff really early.
John
on.
Used his size and his mind to intimidate people all the time. He made it deliberately hard to get to know him, to be close
right.
to him.
Right.
I don't want to say he's the most misunderstood person in the world, because he wasn't misunderstood, because he did it deliberately, Mike. That was his strategy.
He was still
that was his strategy.
Both things could be true. More than one thing could be true about a person.
He was not regarded correctly. All of the stuff about race was unfair. All of it was unfair to accuse him of stuff, but he was... Gosh, I mean...
He was unlike anyone ever. I really agree with that.
The worthiest adversary I ever had. I couldn't say I loved him. I was fascinated by him, and I use all the anecdotes all the time that I can't say on the air now. All the things he said about his players. He was a totally, totally fascinating man.
Completely. And so, just recently, Cheryl and Matthew were on a flight. And Big John was on the flight back to D.C. And Cheryl had met Big John, several times. At the beginning, when we were dating, there was a trip to Miami to cover, I don't know, I guess it was Jordan in the playoffs against Alonzo Mourning. And Big John was at these playoff games. And it was breakfast early in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning in the hotel. And John was in the lobby. John was in the, hotel restaurant.
He never slept.
He called both of us over to his table, and we sat with him. And he said, young lady, I just want to tell you, I hear you went to Virginia and Duke Law School. You must be smart enough not to be involved with this man.
And
it was just great. It was recently. So Cheryl came home. Recently, maybe who knows how many flights John even had since this occasion. And she said, "I saw Coach Thompson on the flight, and we chatted, and he talked to Matthew, and I'm sure that was, I asked Matthew. I said, he's met Patrick Ewing, he's met some Georgetown people, but he never met John. And I'm just glad he met him. And I knew that could, I knew then, whatever, this was less than a year ago, or maybe it was a year ago. But, yeah, Tony, it's another depressing thing. I loved him. Men who have had influence on my life, particularly as an adult. My dad died when I was 27. Big John is right after that. Maybe a couple of my uncles. Big John is right there with influence as a grown man. There were all job offers. There's stuff. There's big life stuff where I was no longer covering him. We were no longer writing about him, and he was someone who, there wasn't any way that the relationship having turned after covering him that I wasn't going to consult him.
People won't get this. They won't know it because they see him as a man at a podium who is antagonistic to the people talking to him. And that's what John wanted to be. And that's fine. So much smarter than you can imagine.
Yeah.
So much smarter.
Yeah.
Just really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I won't let you go without just saying how happy I was that you went. For people who don't know this, Mike belongs to Olympia Fields, where they had the BMW, which just had a spectacular ending. We'll talk to Sands about it. But I'm so glad you got out there just for a little bit. I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, I am too, Tony. The reason I was home this weekend. I mean, I can come here anytime, obviously. I still call it home. 40 years after I've left Chicago, it's home. But part of the reason I came, or the reason I came, was, involvement with. I sort of did the official welcome. The club asked me to do that. It was virtual, and sort of not, sort of not just standing before people, which I would have otherwise. That's what we talked about a year ago when these plans went into effect. And I was glad to get out there. The sports world made it so that it changed my Thursday, Friday, with the NBA and with and boycott and the nature of all the things that were going on. But I was glad, as you know, because I told you about that stuff on Saturday and why I hadn't been out there. And I was glad I went out yesterday and was just there. And it's so different when at a golf tournament when they're not people. And then there were people. There are people.
There's hundreds of people roaming around.
Yeah, but they're not
thousands
necessarily.
No,
but
they're
members.
I
love that place. I love Olympia Fields. I love being a member there. I love hanging out there. And so to just be out there, and I wanted to just talk to people. Listen to a few players I know, some I don't. I wanted to see John Rahm in person, which was, ironic. I stood and watched Dustin Johnson putt and then go to the range. I watched Dustin Johnson for 20 minutes, just stood and watched him. Because you could stand that close. It's like you're on the range with them. And so it's ironic that they came down to the two of them and the golf course. And so, Tony, Olympia Fields had and Sands knows about this even more than I do, where Olympia Fields has had a reputation which suffered because in 2003, when the U.S. Open was here, the last major here, it rained, the course was soft, they had cut the rough, and people had their way with it, Jim Furyk specifically. And there was no more U.S. Open. Coming back here like it's going back to Wingfoot and it's gone back to whatever, Marion and here and there.
Congressional. Yep.
Congressional. So this was sort of an interesting revenge, if you will, because nobody knew this was coming. I know nobody knew it was coming because I was here last week. And I know nobody knew that it was going to be for 3 days it was going to crush the best golfers in the world. And the other half of it was, it not only did it crush the 69 people in the field, they loved it. They thought it was not just fair. They loved it and said so in real time. And so it was great to just be out there and sort of watch. And the weather changed yesterday. It was in the, low 70s, 73, 74, so mid-70s, low to mid. And it was just great to be out there and be around and hear guys talk about how this prepared them, they thought, for Wingfoot in the U.S. Open in a couple of weeks better than anything could prepare them. Tigers.
By the way.
Tiger said, it's been a long, long time since we've played a course like this in a non-U.S. Open situation.
Do you know where it's going to be next year, the BMW? I was told this yesterday.
Yeah, I know where it's going to be. It's going to be at Caves Valley.
At Caves?
Yeah.
At Caves. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's going to be at Caves. And so, what happened this weekend may or may not change the immediate future of Olympia Fields because also – the people who run, I guess, the USGA, I don't know why they do what they do, but they just want to be on the West Coast and the East Coast. They don't seem to really give a damn about being in the middle of the country or being in a place that is a big event place. And Sands can talk to you about that, too, because Sands explained some of this to me. We had a long chat yesterday. I got to hang out with him and Jimmy Roberts in addition to, talking to guys, listening to players and as they came off the course. And it's fascinating to listen to guys who have covered golf forever talk about what happened this weekend, what happened yesterday, and what that could mean for me, which your listeners won't really care about, is what happens, how that may affect this incredible venue. So it was all fascinating. And now, Tony, of course, if today was the final round, given what we just talked about with Big John, I would not be going out there. I'm scared to look at my phone. It has just been, my cell phone has just been buzzing, chirping since we started this conversation. I'm not going to go out there today either.
All right, go to your cell phone. I'll talk to you later. Thanks.
All right, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right. Michael Wilbon, boys and girls, we'll take a break. Indeed, we will have Steve Sands when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Simply Safe ad. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. So while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer, Simply Safe. Simply Safe's got everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. It's got an arsenal of sensors and cameras to blanket every room, window, and door tailored specifically for your home. We have Chessie the dog, who you have heard bark and scream. But we don't.
But in the studio.
We don't have. In the studio, we have all these sensors. So if anybody's in there now, you're on tape.
Messing with the chairs.
Professional monitoring keeps watch day and night, ready to send police, fire, and medical professionals if there's an emergency. You can set it up yourself in under an hour. Just peel and stick the sensors exactly where you need them. Michael can do that. No technician required, and there's no contract, no pushy sales guys, no hidden fees, no fine print, and all this starts at $15 a month. I'm not the only one who thinks that Simply Safe is great. U.S. News & World Report named it, quote, the best overall home security of 2020. So try Simply Safe today at simplysafe.com/Tony. It's S-I-M-P-L-I, people. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. There's nothing to lose. That is simplysafe.com/Tony.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent to us by Ralph Rillen, who says, I'm a longtime listener. I've learned and laughed a lot throughout many years. Thank you for that. The name of the band is DTC. The song is titled See It In Your Eyes. We are a local group performing all over the DMV, although not much right now. Actually, the name of our songwriting group is called Irish Luck, so I hope that works in our favor, and I hope you will favor us by playing our song for all of your littles. Indeed. Indeed we will. And Michael, if groups like DTC and Pat Finnerty want to send us their original music, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com.
And do we sell anything?
Yes. Go check out shop.tonykornheisershow.com. Hard to say your name, Dad.
Yeah.
Where you can get that steel tumbler, which is great for all those iced coffee needs as you are still working from home.
And many are. Steve Sands joins us now. And my first, I was so happy to see him yesterday on the air
over the weekend,
I wrote him a note saying it's so good to actually see you. How did it feel being back at your job live?
It was great. It was, it's been a long, long time. And Valerie drove me to the airport the other day. I think she was going about 140 miles per hour. She couldn't wait for me to get out of the house.
Yeah.
It was nice to get together with the crew again. Like I said, it's been almost 5 months. So since that Thursday at the Players Championship was the last time we were all together on NBC. So that was fantastic. It was bizarre, Tony and Michael, without fans there. I'm sure we'll get into the putts by Dustin Johnson and John Rahm in the playoff. But to watch it on TV the last few months is one thing. And then to actually be there on site in person and feel that lack of energy was.
Well, we did see the number one fan to the right side of the fairway.
Yeah. So Wilbon
made
was
the coverage.
Wilbon was there, and he said you had great conversations, you and Jimmy Roberts and Wilbon, and that you were all impressed. You know, Wilbon feels that the Midwest, and specifically Chicago, is denigrated and not given tournaments because everything's in I-95 or the West Coast. But he said both you guys, you and Jimmy, were really impressed with Chicago and the way they put on the tournament.
Oh, no question. Olympia Fields is mint, man. What a track that is. The last time they held a huge event was the 2003 U.S. Open. They've hosted other U.S. Opens before. They've had U.S. amateurs. They've had some big, big events over the years. It's such a good golf course, and Chicago is such a great city, such a great sports town, such a great golf town. The fact that the USGA does not go there regularly and only goes East Coast, West Coast, I think is a mistake. But I'm a homer to D.C., and we talked about Congressional not getting a U.S. Open and the USGA just getting bagged by Congressional and now going to be a PGA of America site for PGA Championship and a Ryder Cup. You know, the U.S. Open belongs at Congressional in 2026. It's the 250-year anniversary of the country. It's the nation's capital. It's the U.S. Open. And when they stopped giving them the opportunity for that, They went the PGA of America route, and I told Michael that's what Olympia Fields ought to do. If they're not going to give them a U.S. Open, which belongs in Chicago, one of the great cities in this country, then they ought to go the other route by the PGA of America. So it's a major championship town, and that is a major championship venue, man. The players love that golf course.
That's good to know. Oh, by the way, on a personal note, what sort of rigor did you go through? What were the protocols? How much testing? What were you told?
When I arrived, the second I landed, I drove over to a testing site that's done by the PGA Tour. It's about a mile from the golf course. They have an off-site testing site every week. Got tested. It was one of those rapid tests. It's pretty wild. I got, you know, they jam it up your nose, that whole thing. And then within an hour, you find out whether you're positive or negative. If you're negative, you go to the golf course. You have a wristband around your wrist the entire time that allows you to get into certain places because you're technically in the bubble. You know, it was kind of strange in that regard as far as the testing and the masks walking around the golf course. But other than that, it was not a big deal. You in Chicago, things are pretty tight. You can't go eat indoors. You have to eat outside, that kind of thing. So it was a bit of a strange week in that regard, but it was just nice to get back to work, nice to get back with our whole team.
Let me get to the golf course specifically, to Olympia Fields, and Wilbon is a very proud member of it. It had been destroyed by Jim Furyk in the Open 17 years ago, but here's my question. Because the pros killed the track in Boston last week, and Dustin Johnson went minus 31 or whatever he did, did they say to Olympia Fields, set it up hard, we can't have this again?
No, they didn't do that. I think a lot of people were asking me that over the weekend. Olympia Fields is a completely different golf course than TPC Boston. Dustin Johnson went 30 under at TPC Boston. The conditions were ripe for that kind of scoring. Soft golf course, no wind. At Olympia Fields, it was going to be set up difficult anyway because that's the way Olympia Fields and the PGA Tour wanted it to be. The PGA Tour takes over the golf course, not Olympia Fields. So the way the golf course is set up is always going to be predicated on what the officials for the PGA Tour decided to do. They wanted it to be a grind, and it was, and the players loved it. They loved the contrast in styles. You can't have either each week. If you have 48 events that are 30 under, that's going to be kind of boring. If you have 48 events that's going to be, you know, low single digits under par, that's going to be too boring as well. So the contrast in styles was perfect. The conditions at Olympia Fields, even though the golf course was firm and fast, the players would have eaten it up a little bit more if it wasn't for that, you know, famous Chicago wind. And the wind got more difficult and you know, the miles per hour got higher as the day went on, and that's what happened every day. And it was tough, man. And the guys loved the tough conditions. They thought it was really cool.
So let me review what happened late in this tournament. And it is Jon Rahm shoots 64 and has the lead. 64, the best round in the entire tournament. That's minus six. And the leader going into the day is minus one. And he's minus six on one day. So he's on the range, excuse me, because Dustin Johnson still has two holes to play at that point. Dustin Johnson ultimately, having won last week in a runaway, and comes back at a hard golf course and is right in it, right in it. And had he won that tournament outright without a playoff or anything like that, you would have said, wow, this validates everything good about Dustin Johnson. But Dustin Johnson has a bad drive on 17, a bad second shot on 17, pars the hole, a bad drive on 18.
Hardest hole, too.
Yeah, gets lucky. It hits a tree and bounces out, so where he's got a shot, but a bad second shot, and he's 43 feet away. And this is going to be the last shot of the tournament no matter what, because if he misses, Rahm wins, and if he makes, they go to a playoff. So this is it. This is the last shot.
A putt with movement and speed.
And he starts it out on the left-hand side. It hits, you know, the top of the ridge and starts rolling down to the right, comes back to the left, right in the heart of the cup with the pin in. At that moment, I don't do this. I go, oh, my God, in my own house. And I call Wilbon. And Wilbon answers. He goes, what? He goes, Wilbon didn't see it. And I go, oh, my God, he made the putt. And so now you're completely jacked up because of this. And 10 minutes later on the green, Rahm, a poor drive in the rough, a poor second shot, 60 feet away, essentially the same putt, and drains it as well with the pin in. I've never seen that. I know Michael said Justin Thomas and Colin Morikawa, but I've never seen putts of this length that happened twice in a row. Have you ever seen that, Steve?
No, never. It was absolutely incredible. Wilbon pulled a Kornheiser yesterday. He left
early.
Three quarters of the way into the movie.
It was totally nuts.
By the way, can I just tell you, it was so cool hanging out with Wilbon in the parking lot, hearing Chicago stories and hearing him rip on DC summer weather. And
yeah.
It was just a lot of fun to catch up with Michael. He's such a wonderful guy.
He was wearing a vest yesterday.
He was definitely wearing a vest. And he is Mr. Chicago, man. Everybody knows who Michael Wilbon is and having a good time. So let's get back to it. Can I give you one little inside baseball story about what happened there at the end? So because there was Dustin Johnson, it was in the final group, John Rahm finished early. You said that 64. I mean, it was crazy to shoot a 64 on a golf course that was yielding no scores at all week. It was a great round of golf. So Rahm decides, as he's waiting for Dustin Johnson to finish, and he's the only one who can catch him, he's going to go stay loose and go on the range and hit some balls. So I have to go over there. If Dustin Johnson doesn't make birdie at 18, I've got to go over there with our camera guy to interview him as the winner if Dustin Johnson doesn't make a three at 18.
Right.
I realize, you want to stand far away from them, give them their space, do their thing, let him get him do his warm-up and stay loose. But then I realize, you know what? There's no crowd. So he'll never know if he made the putt or not because we don't have a TV monitor out there, and there are no screens out there, and there are no fans. So they have no – he and his caddy, Adam Hayes, have no idea how close he's hit it at 18, if he's made the putt at 18. So I'm just kind of standing about 5 feet from him, and I kind of whisper to Adam and his caddy, would you like to know the situation? And Adam says, absolutely. John then turns around and goes, yes, please tell us. So I said, okay, he hit it through the top of the ridge. It didn't fall down. He's got a really difficult putt left to right, and it's going to wiggle back to the left from about 30 feet away. And I'll let you know when he stands over the putt. Couple of minutes later, standing over the putt, and he makes it, and it's silence. And I just look right at Adam Hayes and John and say, he made it. Just like that, very quietly, he made it. And I always hear, and Michael would know this, you always hear players say in match play or in situations like that, always expect the opponent to make it so that you're like mentally prepared. I'm telling you, so John Rahm's about to win the biggest event of his career, a FedEx Cup playoff event, for the first time. And all I say to him is, he made it. And the two of them, they didn't even blink. He just turned around, hit some more balls, no emotion whatsoever, totally in the moment. I thought that was a really cool thing. He never lost track of what the goal was or what he was looking for or what he was thinking. Hit a few more balls, went to the 18th tee, and then, as you said, made that putt. But what was
he made the same putt 20 feet further out? It's the same putt.
It was remarkable. I mean, it was absolutely remarkable. And everybody around the green, there were a lot of people there, no fans, obviously, but a lot of volunteers and people from BMW and the Western Golf Association, Olympia Fields members, that kind of thing. I mean, it was as loud as you can be with, like, dozens and dozens of people. If it were 30,000 people with Dustin Johnson burying that putt and then John Rahm burying that putt, it would have been as loud as you could possibly be on the PGA Tour. It was incredible, incredible finish yesterday by both guys.
Hey, Steve, that's a really interesting story about Rahm, just given his reputation for being such a hot-headed, emotional player. As you put that in perspective along with the penalty where he just has this mind lapse on Saturday. Are you looking at a player where reaching number one a few weeks back and then losing it just as quickly, where he's had this maturation and you're now really seeing the true potential coming through?
Absolutely. He is so good, and he is becoming great. And it's pretty interesting to watch a guy grow up in front of the world stage. You guys have been around sports forever, just like I have. And you forget these kids come out, they're so young. When he left Arizona State and came out to be professional, he was so young. you know, and now he's maturing. You know, he got married a few months ago. Everything is coming together with his game and his life off the golf course. And he is not a hothead. He is not someone who is going to be around chucking clubs and doing stuff like when he was a kid. And it's pretty interesting to watch to see just how great he has become and how great he can become, because, man, does he have a lot of talent. And as long as he harnesses that energy in a positive way and doesn't let him get in his own way, I think Jon Rahm has a long, long career ahead of him, and there's going to be greatness involved as well. He is a fabulous player.
Looks like a linebacker. He's big.
Yeah, he's a big boy. He's a big boy.
He is. He and Dustin Johnson are big. Dustin Johnson's thin. Rahm is solid. All right, enjoy Atlanta.
Two best players in the world, by the way. Think about this, Tony, about Atlanta. 1-2 in the world golf ranking, Dustin Johnson, Jon Rahm. 3 is Justin Thomas. They're 1-2-3 in the FedEx Cup going into East Lake next week in Atlanta. Things are lining up very nicely for this sport for a big week. Labor Day Monday finish, by the way. It's a Friday start this week. Because of COVID, they had to change everything around. So it's a Monday finish. It's a Friday start, not a Thursday start in Atlanta.
Enjoy yourself. We'll talk to you. Thank you, Steve.
All right, guys. Take care.
Steve Sands, boys and girls. We will come back with jingles and an email. Or jingle and emails. Is email plural? I think email can be both singular and plural.
It works both ways.
Yeah. All right, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. Got your email, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some for all of you.
Thank you, Kirsten. Do you want to do the Bethesda bagel ad, or do you want Michael to do it? Because Michael picked up the bagel sandwiches today.
I'm 2 for 2, 4819, located in the heart of Bethesda, on Bethesda Avenue, just down the street from Calder's Shaved Ice Shop, if you remember that.
So Bethesda bagels, they're very good to us. That does it for us today. Let's just, before we get to the mailbag, oh, here's what Nigel wrote. Fee-fi-fo-fum. Look at Molly now. Here she comes, wearing a wig hat and shades to match. She got a high heel shoes and an alligator hat. Wearing her pearls and a diamond ring. She got bracelets on her fingers now and everything. Devil with a blue dress on. She's a devil with a blue dress on. That is Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, and that is a fabulous song. Thanks to our guests today, Michael Wilbon and Steve Sands. Thanks to our sponsors today, Bespoke Post and Simply Safe. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, radio.com. If you get the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. From Patrick Sitter in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. South Dakota, not I just saw the ad on TV. Pumpkin is back at Dunkin'. Enjoy. I hate pumpkin, as people know. From Papa Thiam in Paris, France. May I humbly request that you allow me to use this platform to ask your listeners to join me in a petition to the ATP. That's the Association of Tennis Professionals. If Novak Djokovic fails to win this year's depleted U.S. Open, they need to take 2 Grand Slams off his career total. What a humiliation it would be if Djokovic, who I don't like, didn't win without Nadal, without Federer, the only person who has ever won this tournament who is in the field, who is seeded. Cilic is seeded 31st. Nobody even knows who he is. From Mitchell May in Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm writing to give you a breakdown on how to properly fold a slice of pie. First, you orient the slice so the point and the crust are sideways in relation to you. Then you go pick up the slice with a 3-finger pinch, placing your thumb on the corner of the crust closest to you. Then place your middle finger on the other corner of the crust. Place your index finger in the middle of the crust and lift the 2 corners up towards each other while keeping the index finger pressed down to create the bend. Once your thumb and middle finger touch, remove the index finger and place it below the crust with your other 2 fingers to support the slice while eating. Once you get to the point in eating where you reach the point where the side starts to come up, then you start to consume the pizza as if it were a taco and rotate your head in the pizza 45 degrees in opposite directions to consume easier. Once you get down to just crust, I like to do a double fold, so repeat the steps again to fold the crust once more. Hope you appreciate the detailed instruction on how to hold a slice of, And he writes in parentheses, New York style, parentheses, pizza. It's really good. And he says, can I be the official D3 tennis player of the show?
Sure.
Do you always eat the crust or do you save it for the end?
I eat the crust after everything else is done. Sometimes I toss it. I don't even care about it. From Ed Jimenez, I'm a longtime listener from the Chicago suburb of Waukegan, Illinois. As a Sox fan, I've delighted to hear you lament the trade that brought us Lucas Giolito. Ultimately, you've acknowledged the trade was worth it because Eaton helped your Nationals win a title. However, I wanted to check in and let you know about a different pitching prospect the Sox received in that same trade. Yep. Even though he is still very young and has gone through Tommy John surgery already, Dane Dunning is looking like another promising young arm. On Sunday, Dunning pitched 5 innings against the Royals where he compiled 7 strikeouts, 1 walk, and no hits.
Well, he's no Austin Voth.
Just to summarize, that's 2 former Washington National pitchers in a week who have allowed no hits in their performance. You can have Fetty and Voth. You can have them. The Nats are done. They're actually done. We're more than halfway through. This isn't 19-31 with 100 to go.
Well, 19-31 still in play.
Yeah, we're more than halfway through. From Bob DeFrades in Tucson, Giolito to Nats. You like that? That's great. That's from...
It is a code red situation.
Yeah, that's from, what's his name, Kirk
Cousins.
Kurt, yeah. Michael Duncan, Lexington, Kentucky. The connectivity of this show continues to amaze me. As it is Kentucky Derby week, I thought you might be interested in a horse racing show-related story. A horse named Sleepy Eyes Todd won the Charlestown Classic Stakes Grade 2 on Friday. The owners assure everyone that the name was about how the horse looked, not the NBC host, but still. I'm pretty sure Chuck Todd doesn't like that nickname, but being the degenerate gambler that he is, a $10 win bet would have earned him $38, providing much-needed salve for his wounds. He didn't have anything else to do last week, so I'm sure he was watching. Alas, the horse is a 4-year-old, so it cannot compete in this year's Derby, but perhaps he can wager on it in the Breeders' Cup World Championship in November. David Israel's horse won again. Microchip or Microburst or whatever the horse's name. It won again. It was
you
a 3-2 favorite.
For that race.
No, I saw the replay. It was 8:40 Eastern time.
Yeah, late.
Jack Weber writes, my dad's 50th birthday is coming up, kid. But I'm making him a birthday video since we can't throw him a party, kid. He's been listening to you since he lived in D.C. in the early 90s. It would be epic if you could be featured in the video saying happy birthday. His name is Jay, and maybe you could mention to him that he needs a haircut. Thanks. I hope this finds you. I've just done it on the air. We're not going to be in a video. Marcus in Phoenix, you opened Friday's show by saying it was guest heavy. Then you closed with Saliz. I had to go back and double check if you said a guest heavy show or a heavy guest show. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Hola, nosotros somos Pineapple Landscaping y escuchamos el show de Tony Kornheiser. Pero este show apesta.
Socially distant from Uncle Ben is taking. To be Will born in 20 from Uncle Benny's table to talk about Chicago to the nth degree. Michael, won't you take the cold tub? Step inside my mind, don't even
Sway the way I want.